Justin. Photos of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau dressed in brown face have Canadians moving through stages of reaction.
You know, the first stage being anger, followed by frustration, driven by the fact that this issue will now consume most of the oxygen in the campaign, at least for the foreseeable future.
Also, world leaders convene at the UN to tackle the climate crisis.
We have an old saying in government service, you know, when your boss shows up to something, they've got to be able to announce something. They don't go empty-handed. So,
in other words, expect some news. Also, what troubling promise did President Trump make to a foreign leader? And migrants in Texas get their day in court under a tent. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Justin Trudeau is having a very bad day. Photos of the Canadian Prime Minister show him wearing dark brown makeup on his face, arms, and hands. The photos were taken at an Arabian Nights-themed party 18 years ago. Trudeau quickly apologized last night and again this afternoon.
This is something that I deeply, deeply regret. Darkening your face, regardless of the context or the circumstances, is always unacceptable because of the racist history of blackface. I should have understood that then, and I never should have done it.
This story lands in the midst of Canada's election campaign. One of Trudeau's political opponents, Jagmeet Singh, said it's up to Canadians to decide if an apology is enough. Singh referenced his own background as a person of color today when reporters asked if he'll shake Trudeau's hand at their next campaign debate.
It's a difficult thing to think about. You know, how do you respond to somebody? How do you look someone in the eye that's mocked the lived reality that I've lived, but more importantly, that so many Canadians have lived? I think he's got a lot to answer for.
So just how might this impact Canada's federal election next month? Omar Khan is a former political strategist for the Liberal Party who's worked with Justin Trudeau.
I went through certain stages after being confronted with the images last night. You know, the first stage being anger, followed by frustration, driven by the fact that as a Liberal strategist, I do know that this issue will now consume most of the oxygen in the campaign, at least for the foreseeable future. And then really culminating in regret, because I do know Justin Trudeau, and I have worked with him. And I know that the Justin Trudeau that I know is not the person that comes across in those images. I don't think any reasonable person, when they take an objective look at his record as prime minister, which has included, you know, really raising issues around diversity, inclusion, and equality of opportunity to the forefront, I don't think any reasonable person could conclude that the prime minister of Canada is bigoted. But I do think it was a gross lack of judgment.
I just want to go back to the fact that Trudeau wasn't a teenager when he wore brown face to an Arabian Nights themed party in 2001. He was a 29-year-old teacher. He was an adult. I mean, maybe he's not racist, but is he clueless?
He was 29. Yeah, and look, I remember when I was in high school, our teachers would explain to us at that time that perhaps we're going to watch an old movie that contained blackface. They would explain the historic context behind it and that it was wrong. So for sure, he should have known that it was wrong then. And I think he said as much last night, to be fair to him. He said that clearly it was a mistake, it was an error in judgment, and it was racist. And I agree with all of those points. I do believe that his apology was sincere, but he's got to work hard now to earn the trust of Canadians.
I think there's something else that people are thinking about. As you said, Trudeau has really paid a lot of attention and been committed to feminism, gay rights, Indigenous rights. But is the Trudeau that we think we know really Trudeau?
The Trudeau that I know is one that stands up at every opportunity he can to fight to rectify historic injustices. But for sure, it was a gross lapse in judgment. And I'd say it was a bad political strategy to wait until we are in the middle of an election campaign and Time magazine dropped the story to speak to these images. You know, if the prime minister knew that these were out there, my strong advice to him would have been to try and get ahead of it, to speak to Canadians honestly about why they existed and how he was sorry that they existed. You know, instead, it did look a little bit reactive last night.
I mean, Trudeau has made quite a few apologies since he was elected. He's given another one now for dressing in brown and blackface. Will that be enough to convince voters before the Canadian election on October 29th that they should vote for his party again?
I think most Canadians are generally forgiving, but they must be convinced that the apology is genuine. You know, my advice has been, I think he needs to come out of his bubble a little bit. I think he needs to engage directly with Canadians. He's very good in town hall settings. He needs to do more of those. And Canadians need to see that he understands the gravity of the situation here. And look, I think at the end of the day, you know, the 60% of the electorate that identifies as progressive will need to make a decision. There are really only two people on the ballot in Canada who have a chance of becoming the Prime Minister. One is Conservative Party leader Andrew Scheer, and one is Liberal Party leader Justin Trudeau. And there are quite stark differences between both of their outlooks for where they want to take this country. This is something that Trudeau will have to work on for the rest of this campaign, but, you know, probably for the rest of his political career, to repair that trust and to really show Canadians that he's worthy of their forgiveness.
Omar Khan is vice president at Hill & Knowlton Strategies. He's a former political strategist for the federal and Ontario Liberal parties and has worked with Justin Trudeau. Thanks a lot, Omar.
My pleasure.
This whole incident got us thinking about people putting on dark makeup and the history of where brownface or blackface comes from in the Canadian context. The World's Rupa Shenoy has more.
Blackface, the racist portrayal of black people as caricatures, was a creation of American minstrel shows of the 1830s. By the 1840s, those shows had reached Canada, and they were popular.
So that means it's just as Canadian?
Cheryl Johnson's a professor of media studies at Ryerson University in Toronto. She's been studying blackface for 10 years, and she was working on an article about this for the Toronto Star when we spoke. Johnson says brownface, as people are calling what Trudeau did, it's basically the same thing as blackface.
So it's like a derivative. You can't really say that it's something separate. It's coming from the same root.
And it's used in the same way, Johnson says, to humiliate. She compares Trudeau's 18-year silence about appearing in brownface to being betrayed by a lover.
Say if you're in a relationship and your partner cheated on you 18 years ago and never said anything, and then you find out today. I think you're going to think that that matters to you.
To Johnson, it means that Trudeau has been disingenuous when he's publicly supported diversity and inclusion.
Because it means that behind closed doors, you are the object of ridicule and mockery. But outside of those doors, they could be greeting you and treating you and smiling at you. And so you think you have an honest person that really sees you and understands you. And then behind closed doors, they're using you for entertainment purposes. And I think that's the link that people aren't understanding. Black and brown people have historically, it doesn't matter what country you're in, been the objects of ridicule and derision, right? For centuries. So when we see something like this, it just conjures up everything that we personally have experienced.
White Canadians haven't confronted this kind of racism, in part because they've always seen themselves in contrast to Americans, says Melissa Gismondi. She's a lecturer at the University of Virginia who studied something called Canadian exceptionalism.
Especially after 2016 and the election of President Trump, that Canada has kind of become this liberal beacon of hope in a world that's kind of seemingly gone mad.
She says that's kept some Canadians from dealing with persistent problems.
We don't talk about these issues enough in Canada, whether it's racism, whether it's settler colonialism, and issues like what's going on right now with the photos of Justin Trudeau in blackface and brownface are kind of thrusting it in our faces and forcing us to talk about these issues that many Canadians like to pretend aren't there and like to would prefer not to talk about, I think.
The reality of history is that there was also slavery and segregation in Canada. Barrington Walker, a history professor at Queen's University, says that's often not taught in Canadian schools. He's a politician in an opposing party to Trudeau, who's running for election.
So when these sorts of incidents emerge in the Canadian context, they're met by this kind of stupefying innocence around the way that Canadians think about or often think about racism.
As a result, he says, disparities persist today.
There's still a wealth gap between Black Canadians and non-Black Canadians. We have issues in our criminal justice system. We have problems at the employment market. So there are a number of issues that still confront Black Canadians in the 21st century.
Today, thanks to Trudeau, all Canadians are confronting the legacy of racism in their country. just as they choose their next leader. For The World, I'm Roopa Shenoy.
On Monday, world leaders meet in New York for a UN climate summit. The UN Secretary General personally called the meeting. He wants countries to start slashing carbon emissions fast. The World's Carolyn Beeler reports on what we can expect.
I have asked you here to sound the alarm.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres announced this summit last year, and he made it clear that what countries were doing on climate change wasn't enough.
The mountain in front of us is very high, but it is not insurmountable. The leaders of the world need to step up.
At this upcoming summit, he said he doesn't want to hear speeches. He wants to hear specific plans on how countries will cut carbon emissions enough to avoid the most devastating impacts of climate change.
And I want to hear about how we are going to stop the increase in emissions by 2020 and dramatically reduce emissions to reach net zero emissions by mid-century.
Net zero emissions by 2050. When countries signed on to the Paris Agreement, they committed to these specific carbon cuts. But Andrew Light, who was a climate negotiator in the State Department at the time, says those first promises are not enough.
So if you take the collective commitments from all the parties, they actually don't add up to the temperature targets under Paris.
The agreement was written to sort of start slow and then let countries, as policy wonks say, ratchet up their ambition in these five-year cycles.
We're now approaching the first ratcheting mechanism that's mentioned in the agreement.
By 2020, countries are expected to set new goals. But that's actually voluntary. Most countries could just say, yeah, that first goal we set, the one that's not really enough, we're going to stick with that one. The summit next week is aimed at putting pressure on world leaders to be more aggressive.
We have an old saying in government service, you know, when your boss shows up to something.
Say when your boss is the president coming to the UN.
They've got to be able to announce something. They don't go empty-handed. So you sort of like you create the stage. And so the meeting itself creates a kind of a forcing event.
The Secretary General has even told world leaders, you only get on the stage at the summit if you've got something big to announce. If you don't, you don't. No limelight for you. Here's the UN's special envoy for the summit, Luis Alfonso de Alba.
It's a meeting which has been called not to listen to speeches, but to look into specific actions.
De Alba says he and Antonio Guterres have been crisscrossing the globe to meet with heads of state, trying to get them to commit to these specific actions, like a plan to cut emissions nearly in half by 2030, or a promise not to build new coal-fired power plants after next year.
We have been traveling. The Secretary General has undertaken a number of bilateral meetings. We have been meeting with the private sector. It is a very intense program.
The Secretary General's diplomatic efforts have focused on G20 countries, which produce about 80% of global carbon emissions. But that is just a start.
We are looking into getting the majority of countries. This is something that we will see at the summit itself.
The summit the UN is hosting Monday is similar to a meeting it held a year before the Paris Accord was brokered. But there was a key difference back then. The U.S. had been working behind the scenes for years to help pave the way for the landmark 2015 agreement. That's not happening this time around. The U.S. will be represented at the summit by a deputy assistant secretary from the State Department, but don't expect any big announcements from the summit stage. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Tomorrow, students worldwide will go on strike from school to demonstrate for action against climate change. The Friday climate strikes have been building momentum for months, but tomorrow's strike has a special audience in mind, world leaders at the United Nations. Join us for that story tomorrow. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. There's no question that getting into the U.S. as a migrant seeking asylum has become much more complicated. The Supreme Court recently upheld a new policy, at least temporarily, that bans nearly all non-Mexican migrants who did not first seek asylum elsewhere. There's also this new controversy. Migrants are getting their day in court in tents. These makeshift courts are set up along the Texas-Mexico border with remote link-ups to judges in other parts of the country. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, has been following the emergence of these new temporary courtrooms. Monica, what are these new makeshift courts?
So far, there are two of them. And they're these spaces set up in tents, you know, not one you'd use for a wedding, but perhaps much smaller, but, you know, pretty sturdy something that they put up quickly and can take down quickly. And then within these spaces, there are video link-ups to judges in different parts of the country, particularly San Antonio right now. And this system is set up for people in what's called the Remain in Mexico program. And that keeps people in Mexico, asylum seekers in Mexico, while their cases are decided in a U.S. immigration court. And more than 40,000 migrants have been sent back to Mexico under this program.
So I know these new courts are controversial. Why?
Well, access is a big concern. This is not a traditional courthouse. The ability for advocates to go in to do Know Your Rights presentations for migrants who may not have lawyers, and most migrants don't have lawyers, that ability for that person to go in there has been blocked so far. So lawyers and advocates say that these structures, these tent-like courts, feel like black holes. But Carol, you know, the bigger concern is that these courts are expanding a program that keeps asylum seekers in Mexico in some of the most dangerous parts of Mexico. So these two courts are alongside the Mexican state of Tamaulipas. I won't go there as a reporter, or I will take extreme safety measures if I'm going to go report in that part of Mexico. It's cartel country. And this is where families are having to travel through to go to these court hearings. And they need to show up at the court hearing before dawn, 4:30 a.m., in order to get processed and ready to go and see this judge. So you have families, often with small kids, even toddlers, moving through this very dangerous part of Mexico. And I spoke with one advocate, her name is Yael Shahar, about this. And she was in the room where the judge was in San Antonio. And the judge was seeing migrants through this video link up and hearing what they said. And here's what Shahar observed.
One woman asked the judge for a change of venue, saying, like, you know, I'm scared to stay in Nuevo Laredo until my next hearing. Can you change it so that I could have a hearing at another port? And she basically said, you know, all ports are very crowded right now. The most important thing we could do for you is to make sure that we speed up your case. So at the next hearing, you know, you present your asylum case. By next month, we already address your asylum case. So her goal was to sort of speed through the cases. That was her major priority.
How has the U.S. government defended the creation of these courts and the Remain in Mexico program in general?
So the Trump administration says that these kind of makeshift courts allow for more people to move through the system. We saw, you know, of course, all the news of many, many people approaching the U.S.-Mexico border over the past year or so. And the administration says that this is an adequate response to more people approaching the border and that more judges are attending more people. They also defend the Remain in Mexico program by saying that it sticks to the government's goal of not allowing migrants to be released and live in the United States while their court cases play out in the U.S.
Monica, you've been in touch with many migrants who've been part of this Remain in Mexico program. Have their situations changed?
They have. I have been in touch with a number of people. Some remain in Mexico and are working in Mexico and just kind of a day-to-day existence, sharing rooms with other migrants. Some of the people I've been in touch with, I've sent them messages through WhatsApp, you know, through their cell phones. I see that they are not reading their messages, which makes me think that either they've crossed into the U.S. and perhaps were apprehended and maybe in a detention center in the U.S., or perhaps their cell phone was stolen, which is pretty common. I did speak with one mom who I've been in touch with. She's from Honduras, and she migrated to the U.S.-Mexico border with three small children from Honduras. She was put in this Remain in Mexico program, so she waited in Tijuana for months, just across from San Diego. When she went to see an immigration judge, she told the judge that she didn't want to return to Mexico because she was living in an extremely dangerous part of Tijuana. And she's said the border officials there allowed her to remain in the United States. So when I called her the other day and I asked, where are you? And she said, I'm in a shelter in San Diego. And so this is what she said. It's a very scratchy line because she was still using her Mexico cell phone and we were talking over WhatsApp. So it's really scratchy. She says, thank God that we're in the United States. She said, someone took my word that I felt genuinely scared in Mexico, and they decided to let me stay in the U.S. So she feels very lucky.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. Thanks a lot, Monica.
You're welcome.
When I see a sunflower, for some reason, it just makes me happy. I'm not unique. The sunflower emoji is a symbol of love and happiness. But those big, cheery yellow blooms aren't just pretty faces. Sunflowers are good at absorbing toxic radiation. After the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster in Japan, millions of sunflowers were planted nearby. What's more amazing, it's been discovered that these yellow flowers can communicate and actually collaborate with each other. A team of scientists from the University of Alberta in Canada found that sunflowers are aware of each other's existence and react to one another. For example, if there are two sunflowers planted next to each other, they can agree to work together in order to benefit from their food source. Professor James Cahill is a lead author of the team that discovered this.
When I was a graduate student, we were taught that plants just receive and they don't do much. What we're actually finding is that the behavior of plants and plant roots is as complex as we see in social animals and in most any other study system.
But it's not always harmonious in the sunflower fields. They can act selfish, too, and borrow a textbook move from the first grade playground. When one sunflower perceives a future threat from a neighboring sunflower, it will suck up the nutrients from its roots as quickly as possible before the intruding neighbor can get to it.
Plants make a lot of decisions about the social context they live in and the distribution of nutrients. And we've, as scientists, have really underestimated how complex the life of a plant is.
And scientists are finding that it's not just sunflowers that communicate. Acacia trees in South Africa warn each other in the form of a gas if their leaves are being eaten by antelopes or giraffes. And Argentine cabbages can also send out a gas to alert their neighbors of predators nearby. It's kind of like a botanical crime watch. You're with the world. When you think of great comedians, you probably don't think of the Soviet Union.
It's true. Not only was there stand-up comedy in the Soviet Union, it was wildly popular in the 70s and the 80s, but the humor that actually reached audiences was heavily censored.
A new film about the wild world of Soviet comedy, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Here's two things you don't often hear in the same breath. The Soviet Union and comedy. How is it even possible to be funny with all the censorship? The Soviets found a way to make it work. So much so, the Cold Warrior, President Ronald Reagan, was a big fan of Soviet humor. He collected stories told among Russians.
And one of these stories, the one I'm going to tell you, I told to General Secretary Gorbachev. And he laughed. The story was an American and a Russian arguing about their two countries. And the American said, look, in my country, I can walk into the Oval Office, I can pound the president's desk and say, Mr. President, I don't like the way you're running our country. And the Russian said, I can do that. The American said, you can? He says, yes. I can go into the Kremlin, to the general secretary's office, pound his desk and say, Mr. General Secretary, I don't like the way President Reagan's running his country.
It's not easy to tell a Soviet-era joke. Many of them are these long monologues. And if you didn't grow up in that time period, they can be hard to get. Latvian-American Michael Idov has made a film, a drama, about a Soviet stand-up comedian set in the 1980s. It's called The Humorist.
Now, we've always been fascinated by the very notion of Soviet humor, the fact that in a country where you pretty much couldn't joke about anything, some of the biggest celebrities were professional jokers. And it's true, not only was there stand-up comedy in the Soviet Union, it was wildly popular in the 70s and the 80s, but the humor that actually reached audiences was heavily censored. Every joke had to be approved and sort of signed off on. And I just kept thinking about what a strange life these people must have led.
Now, the main character in your film, Boris Arkadyev, what's his story? How would you describe him?
So Boris Arkadyev is a failed writer of serious fiction who turns to stand-up as apparently a way to support his family and finds he is wildly popular at it. And he despises himself and he despises his audiences for loving him.
обезьяна, то сразу Патрис Лумумба, да? Расизм какой? Его и отчество еще есть. Какое?
The main thing to know about Boris Arkadyev, and this is immediately apparent to a Russian-speaking viewer of the film, is that it's not a real name. It's a Russianized version of a Jewish last name, because this is the price that a lot of people in that industry had to pay.
Now, some of the scenes in the movie show Boris, the character, you know, being woken up in the middle of the night and taken somewhere far away to perform for someone, or taken to private parties of KGB members and higher-ups in the Kremlin. Did those kind of things actually happen to the real Soviet-era comedians?
Absolutely, absolutely. And they still do. That's the fun part. Because I based this on a real story told to me by a friend involving one of the major comedians of the Soviet era, who was, in fact, dragged out of his bed in the middle of the night. When I was casting the movie and I was talking to various modern-day comedians, I found out that this kind of thing still goes on. These days, when people come for them, it doesn't feel like it could turn into an arrest at any moment. But still, this whole notion that if you are a successful comedian in Russia, that you are also a bit of a court jester and you have a duty to the motherland to entertain certain people, it's still true.
Do you like Soviet humor?
No, I don't. In fact, I hate it. It feels defeatist and depressing to me, and especially after I've rifled through tons of it for the movie.
It's interesting, because in your movie, Boris is partly depressed and troubled because he's constantly asked to repeat the same joke, and the joke isn't very funny. But in private, Boris is really funny, and I assume that was intentional on your part.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It's actually very important to me because if his material was brilliant, it would make the movie really, really simple. It would be one of those brilliant artist versus the evil state movies. And I was much more interested in the struggle within Boris Arkadyev.
Were you trying to make a comment with your film about contemporary Russia?
Honestly, yes, for sure. If the comment is only that not much changed. I mean, that's a simple comment, but it happens to be true. And there's a song at the closing credits of the movie sung by a widely popular young rapper named Face, who did this song specifically for the movie. Нам не выжить без смеха, прям как без русского мата. Мой отец КГБшник, а моя мать с автоматом, и мои дети. And that song provides a very direct link between the events of the movie and today, because Face is, in fact, one of those young performers who suffered heavily from censorship and the new kind of political pressure. And his concerts were also banned, and he's run into a lot of trouble for his art. So having him come at the end of the movie and do this closing song, for me, was the most direct link I could possibly provide between 1984 and today.
Wrap it for us.
Nope.
Okay.
Nice try, though.
Michael Idov is a Latvian-American filmmaker. His film about a Soviet-era comedian is called The Humorist. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you.
Get a sneak peek of The Humorist and learn more about the history of Soviet comedy at theworld.org. Indians are the second largest consumers of tobacco behind the Chinese. Indians still mostly smoke rolled paper cigarettes. Vaping hasn't really taken off there. Still, India's cabinet announced today that they will be banning e-cigarettes due to public health concerns. The move comes as countries like the United States deal with increasing problems with young people and vaping. In the U.S., 7 recent deaths have been linked to vaping-related illnesses. We're joined by Chavi Sachdev, a reporter based in Mumbai. She said the ban seemed to come out of nowhere.
People are really surprised. Everybody seems to have thought it just came out of the blue. There's really no precedent for it. And of course, everybody on social media is quick to jump into all kinds of conspiracy theories, including that the government is colluding to push actual tobacco sales because the Indian government is a shareholder in one of our biggest tobacco companies.
The tobacco market in India is huge, but what is the vaping market like? I mean, do you see people on the streets vaping?
Not at all. So I just spent a month in England, and I felt like when I got out of the subway, every 10th person at least had a vape in their hand. In India, I know one person who uses a vape, and I've checked around in my circle, and most people know perhaps a handful of people. Young people seem to smoke it, mostly, I think, in the IT industry or maybe in hipper circles, but it's just not that prevalent. I was talking to somebody who said he's got access to Amazon India's sales figures for vape cartridges, and that number every month is about 15,000 orders. That's just not a lot, especially compared with cigarettes. I've also been told that most vapers here buy their cartridges abroad, but it is very expensive, and maybe that's one of the reasons it hasn't picked up.
If vaping hasn't really taken off in India, why the preemptive measure? I mean, is it an overreaction or is it trying to prevent something from happening?
Well, the government's stance is that it is a preemptive, proactive measure to protect the youth who are linking vaping with being cool, and so they're nipping it in the bud, so to speak, before it can become a full-blown health crisis. Whether that's true is hard to tell, because it seems like they're curtailing something before it had even begun to catch on. 60% of India doesn't even know what vaping is, according to some statistics I've seen.
It's interesting because vaping in the U.S. and I think in Canada and other places, it's already a public health issue, and it's very much around young people. It's interesting that a country as large as India is taking action on something that other countries like the U.S. hasn't really come to grips with.
I'm surprised as well. In fact, I was shocked that India beat the U.S. to it. There's so much public debate happening in the U.S. We see that President Trump is talking about it, and there's print media and podcasts covering it. We really haven't had any of that happening. In fact, as we speak, it's still listed for sale on Amazon India, and I didn't go ahead and purchase it, but I have been able to add it to my cart, and despite the ban, I could still be buying it. So it's all very confusing.
Is there any kind of chatter that maybe India did this because it can and therefore score points as sort of being on top of this issue, which isn't even an issue?
Well, it's absolutely possible. There is some chatter. There's even some chatter saying that Modi's trying to curry points with Donald Trump.
Chavi, one of the reasons why we did this story is because India is such a huge country. As we've said, the second largest consumer of tobacco products. And sitting in the U.S., which is grappling with this vaping epidemic among young people and public health officials worried about it, we wake up today and India is banning it. So it seems like, wow, they're way ahead of the U.S. But it sounds like it's not looking like this big achievement in India.
It seems like a lot of sound and fury, but there's really not much substance to it. It's affecting a very tiny minority of people in urban, corporate, India, possibly in the creative or tech industry, who can even afford this as an indulgence. And even with the ban, they've got enough and more cheaper alternatives anyway. It really is a damp squib in some ways.
Chavi Sachdev is a reporter in Mumbai. Thanks a lot, Chavi.
Thanks, Carol.
Did President Trump make a troubling promise to a foreign leader? That's the potential bombshell on Capitol Hill today. President Trump has denied any wrongdoing. In a tweet, President Trump said he would only do what is right and only do good for the USA. He was responding to a story in the Washington Post. That report has not been verified, and Trump calls it fake news. But Congress is taking it seriously. At the heart of this story is a complaint from a whistleblower within the U.S. government. The Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, Michael Atkinson, reviewed the complaint and found it both credible and a matter for urgent concern. Atkinson even breached protocol to report it directly to Congress after his boss refused to do so. Today, Atkinson, the Inspector General, or IG, appeared before the House Intelligence Committee. And believe it or not, that's where this story gets really complicated. Atkinson informed Congress that he couldn't give any details. That's because the Department of Justice had interfered by ruling the information privileged. The chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Democrat Adam Schiff, said this after the closed-door meeting.
Given that it involves something that the IG has already found to be serious and credible and evidence of wrongdoing of one kind or another, there is no privilege that covers that. There is no privilege to conceal that. There is no privilege to be corrupt.
Schiff was careful not to name President Trump as the subject of the complaint, but given what had happened already and ruling out possibilities, Schiff concluded this.
It likely involves either the president or people around him.
So what exactly is going on here? Margaret Taylor is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and a senior editor of the Lawfare blog. Previously, she served as a senior attorney for the House Foreign Relations Committee.
So we don't know a whole lot about the content of the actual complaint. What we do know is that the process by which whistleblowers are supposed to submit these complaints to Congress was not followed in this instance. The relevant piece of legislation lays out a very specific process for people in the intelligence community to put forth whistleblower complaints that they want to communicate to the Congress. First, they submit them to the intelligence community's inspector general, and then that inspector general is supposed to be the one who makes the decision about whether the information is credible and whether it is of urgent concern. And if he determines that that is the case, in this case, it's the inspector general's name is Michael Atkinson, he is required then to submit it, the information, to the director of national intelligence, which is Joseph McGuire, who's serving in an acting capacity at this point. And then 7 days after that, the director of national intelligence is required by the statute to submit the information to the Congress. That last piece didn't happen.
And so how do we even know that Joseph McGuire didn't do what he's supposed to do?
Well, what we understand from public reporting is that the Intelligence Community Inspector General, Michael Atkinson, actually alerted the committee himself that he had made his determination and submitted the information to the Director of National Intelligence. So the understanding in the press is that is how Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, learned of the existence of this whistleblower complaint.
Now, the Washington Post is saying this whistleblower case involves President Trump communicating with a particular foreign leader. What's the significance of that? President Trump meets with lots of foreign leaders.
So I think the significance is that the Inspector General of the intelligence community made a determination that whatever this complaint was a matter of urgent concern and was credible. And the relevant statute specifically says that that does not include complaints that address differences of opinions concerning public policy matters aren't relevant under this statute. So the inspector general clearly determined that whatever this complaint was didn't relate to differences of opinions concerning public policy matters. And so the question is, what was it? The statute, you know, allows complaints to be forwarded that address a serious or flagrant problem, abuse, violation of law or executive order, or deficiency related to an intelligence activity.
So bottom line, how big of a deal is this?
I think it depends on what ends up being the actual content of the complaint. If the content of the complaint is really something that's flagrant and abusive, then this will continue to be a big deal. And I do think that if Chairman Schiff and the intelligence committees generally don't get the answers they need, this will continue to fester. We won't see the end of this until the intelligence committees are satisfied that there's not a real problem here.
Margaret Taylor is senior editor of the Lawfare blog. She's also a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks for speaking with us, Margaret.
Thank you.
Athletes on Iran's national judo team are about to have a lot more spare time. That's because Iran is now banned from participating in international competitions. It goes back to Tokyo last month at the World Championships. Iranian Saeed Molai walked off the mat, head hung low. He was the defending world champion, and he'd lost.
In Tokyo, I left the arena with tears in my eyes. I will never forget what happened there. I could have achieved my third world championship medal and my second gold medal. I was so ready and prepared. I'd seen that readiness in myself. On that day, in that very place, I made a promise to God and myself that someday, in that same place, I have to win the best medal.
He said during the tournament, Iranian officials had called him multiple times and told him to withdraw. That's because if he kept winning, he'd eventually face Sagi Mouki, an athlete representing Israel. Here's why that would have been a problem. Iran's government does not recognize Israel and therefore refuses to compete against it. It's not the first time Iranian officials have asked their judo athletes to boycott the Israelis, but this time was different.
So it was the first time ever that we had evidence.
The evidence was testimony, says Nicholas Messner, a spokesperson for the International Judo Federation. And telling an athlete to throw a match for political reasons violates international rules, hence the ban. Malai, the Iranian athlete, refused to withdraw from the tournament, but ended up losing before he had the chance to face his Israeli opponent. Malai has fled to Germany. His goal? He wants to go back to Tokyo to compete again in the 2020 Olympics. Nicholas Messner says the International Judo Federation is working with the athlete to make this happen.
And now we are together with him, I mean, studying all the possibilities, because his dream remains to participate in the Olympic Games next year in Tokyo and to win the gold medal.
The reaction in Iran has been mixed. The leader of Iran's judo program has called the ban unfair. The ban certainly comes at an interesting time for Iran. Tensions are especially high right now between Iran and Israel. Israel admitted to recently bombing a weapons facility being used by Iran. But international competition, at its heart, was designed as a way for nations to compete, to bring them together. And Nicholas Messner says the essence of judo isn't just about fighting. It's also about personal development, which includes respecting your opponent.
In 1882, when Jigoro Kano in Japan invented judo, he said, I want to develop an activity that will help people physically and mentally develop to become better citizens.
One footnote, the Israeli athlete Sagi Muki won the world championships. So the road to Olympic gold will likely go through Israel. Finally, let's close today's program with a conversation I recently had with Welsh musician Gruff Rhys. He has a new album out. It's called Pang. The language is Welsh and the music is groovy. Here's the title track. Pang o eiraeth, pang o fyrraeth, pang o iawgrwydd, pang o gwylydd, pam dyfaru, pam yn llipio, cam ddefnyddio. Grim mae peidio Pang o eogrwys Pang o enwogrwys Pang o eogrwys Pang o enwogrwys Gruff, where did the title come from? I mean, the album's called Pang with exclamation point. I mean, I think of pang as a kind of torturous emotion.
Yeah, I think generally the album's quite uplifting and it's a hopeful record. But even on, you know, on good days, especially these days, you know, you're having a good day and then you listen to the news or something and get a pang of reality.
Yeah, there's a lot of panging going on these days.
For sure.
I don't speak Welsh, but you do address political issues in your songs. Distrust of authority, fake news, globalization. What about your climate change song, Eli Hall, in Welsh? I'm sure I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. What are you saying in that song?
That song's a really abstract song. It's not a protest song as such, but I was trying to evoke a feeling of melting. I wanted to write lyrics and music that sounded like it was melting. So it's quite abstract. Eli Hall, wyt ti'n gwrando tra'n ysmwytho Eli Hall. I think climate crisis is on everybody's mind, especially as a touring musician.
Your own impact,
yeah,
touring?
Yeah. Also, there's a global political crisis, especially in the short term, in particular in Wales, in the UK. Bela drai cythryblis, bela drai am ffodus
Eli Hall. Do you see yourself as just a musician who wants to express your own thoughts and ideas musically, or do you feel like music for you at this point is a way to convey the really weighty issues that we're all facing around the world?
Primarily, it's a musical expression, and you know, music reaches beyond language, and that's the power of it. And it's possible to evoke, you know, to create feelings, and then within that, the lyrics are reflections of my life. It's a diary of the time I'm living in. Ar gwan, ar wyfren,
and a quint.
Your new album, it's a global sounding album, and on the tune Taranumai, I hear what sounds like tablas and a didgeridoo.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I didn't know how many people would pick up on that. We were in the studio mixing, and me and Muzi, and Muzi mentioned that the song was sounding really exotic to him, that the Welsh language sounded exotic, and we decided to put every exotic sound we could imagine onto one track.
And Muzi is, of course, a South African electronic artist yeah. and producer who helped you with this album.
Yeah.
The album is called Pang. Gruff Rhys stopped by our studios earlier this week to talk about it. And that does it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.